Welcome to Funds That Won, where we dive into some of the world's most renowned investment funds. We'll interview investment managers across the alternative landscape and learn how they built their million and even billion dollar asset management empires. We'll explore teams, structures, strategies, and best practices in launching and running alternative investment funds.
All right, we got some fun stuff to talk about today, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be a good conversation. We're going to be talking about private market investment offerings. It's your deal. It's your opportunity. It's your product that you're taking to market, right? And you got to sell your customers on this product, aka your investors. And there's a million things that you can talk about when you're selling your private market offering, but we've narrowed it down to kind of the four core pillars of your investment offering. So whether you're on your first fund or your 50th, it's all about the fundamentals, right? Like simple sells. And so you got to focus on the core aspects of your offering. So let's get into it. The four core pillars of your investment offering, things you have to talk about. You have to sell your investor on your asset class. You have to sell them on your strategy. You have to sell them on your team. And you have to sell them on your structure. These four components make up your private market offering. So let's jump into it. First and foremost is your asset class. You know, this is really like what you're answering the question, what are you investing in? Now, there's a bunch of different types of asset classes. I would say the core five are real assets, pretty self-explanatory, hedge funds, trading on the public markets, private equity, buying businesses, venture capital, investing in early stage businesses, private credit is just a fancy form of debt, private lending, think about it that way. There's other core alternatives, but these are the core that I tend to work with. And it's important to note that venture is a subset of private equity, but they're different enough for emerging fund managers. We treat them very differently. And then there's others, right? So as you're putting your fund together, some of your investors aren't going to know what private equity means. They don't know that word, right? You have to explain to them what is private equity. If you're talking to institutional grade allocators or sophisticated allocators, they know, they've already predetermined their asset allocation. They know what private equity is. But it's important to make sure that your investors understand your asset classes. And furthermore, your sub-asset classes. In each of these asset classes, there's a million different, you know, sub-products. In real estate, you've got commercial, residential, mixed use, hospitality. In hedge funds, you can be trading equities, fixed income, commodities. In private credit, there's mezz debt, there's distressed debt, there's venture debt, there's all these different types of debt. And again, your investors have to understand your asset holistically. Now, it's important to note as well that a lot of you guys tend to want to come out and do like a multi-asset fund. I don't know why, that just everyone wants to do that right at the beginning. I've said it before, I'll say it again. I think it's a lot easier to start with one and then scale into other asset classes later. Establish yourself as an expert, and then you can start getting into other asset classes or sectors. So when you are pitching your fund, the first pillar of your investment strategy, you gotta sell them on the asset, right? Talk to investors about like why should I have exposure to this type of asset class? What are the characteristics of this asset class? Is it income producing? Is it a growth play? Is it depreciation? Like, what are the benefits? Like, why is this asset class well positioned to invest in over the next few years, right? You're essentially answering the question, why now? And then what data, always use data and trends that support, like, it's not just coming from you, but show the data, show the hard data that supports why this is a great asset class to have exposure to. So sometimes when you're pitching a fund, your asset class can be like part of your edge. Right? Asset classes can be very interesting. They can be novel. They can be niche. For example, a fund that we worked with, RV Storage Partners. I mean, they essentially buy land, they put concrete on it, they paint lines, and then they rent out the lots, right? Like, it's so simple, but like that's a little more of a novel strategy or untraditional strategy that's attractive to investors. Also, your asset class can be, it can sometimes hurt you, right? If it's more of a unique asset class, then sometimes it can be harder to sell. So, first pillar of your investment strategy, gotta sell them on the asset class. Second, You got to talk about your strategy. And this is really answering the question, how are you investing? So with all these different asset classes that we talked about, there's different approaches to this asset, right? There's different ways you can attack the market. In real estate, there's core investing, core plus, value add, right? In hedge funds, you can be long, short, market neutral, global macro. In private equity, there's LBOs, there's venture, there's growth equity. There's all these different ways that you can go out and attack the market. And that's really where you get to demonstrate your alpha, right? Adam talked a little bit about it yesterday, but there's three types of alpha in the world. There's analytical alpha, there's behavioral alpha, and there's informational alpha. And all strategies derive from there. So I wanna actually do a quick exercise with you guys. Close your eyes. Everyone close your eyes right now. Close them up. You just made $100 million. Maybe you ran a fund or something. Maybe you sold a business, but you have a lot of money to invest right now. All right, you just sat down with some experts and they're talking to you about asset allocation. And you've determined that, hey, I want 15% exposure to real estate. And so now your objective is to go identify the best opportunities in real estate. All right, open your eyes. So now you guys are in the frame, hopefully, of you're an allocator, right? How do allocators think? How are they looking at deals, right? You got all this money. You've already sat down. You've predetermined how much money you want exposure to real estate, and then you start sourcing deals. And you start looking through hundreds of real estate decks. And let's assume that it's just all, you want all that to be multifamily value add. So you've now looked through hundreds of opportunities in multifamily value add, and there's some easy ones you push to the side, right? Maybe they didn't really have experience, or maybe they didn't have the right team, they didn't have anything together. But you narrowed it down to your favorites, and then you come to your top two, all right? And you're trying to make a decision between these final two candidates that you're going to place a bunch of your money with. One of them, and this is a true story. This just happened recently. Like one of them, they had formerly been a contractor, and so they are able to get all of their materials at cost, and so they don't have to pay markup on any of their products. And they went ran all the calculations, and they believe that they can produce a 1.2% premium on top of whatever any other multifamily value add investor can do. Right, and so it's something small, right? But it's very specific, and that is an example of an edge. Like, who are you going to go with, right? Are you going to go with the guy that has that little, alpha, that form of alpha, that edge, or somebody who doesn't, right? It's always going to be the person that has the edge, and so your edge can come in a variety of ways. It can be your team, which we'll talk about in a minute. It can be your strategy. It can be your asset class. I just came from Texas. I pitched probably 20 family offices over the past 2 days. And I mean, almost in all of the conversations, every single one of them asked me about my deal flow, right? I think one of your best edges that you can have in a fund is a proprietary source of deal flow. I think that's like cream of the crop. It's hard to beat that, okay? Why? Because if there's good opportunities, then you're gonna make good investments. So in just a second, if you can pull the slides back up for me. We recently partnered with a firm, All In Ventures. If I can get the slides back on the, thank you. Phenomenal firm. This guy, he's done 27 deals already. He has a 4.67 DPI, phenomenal track record. Distributions to paid in capital, if you don't know what that means. Phenomenal track record. We're really excited about this venture fund. We went through and analyzed a bunch of different seed venture funds, but we really liked this one. And we chose to work with them for a lot of reasons because of their proprietary edge. And so instead of me telling you about it, we've actually got them here backstage with us. So could you guys all give me a hand in welcoming Thomas Wilkinson to the stage? From the theme song, I let the black jeans on, and the mean song, and getting my screen on, and then it came on. Take it away,
thanks,
Tom.
Thanks for the welcome, guys. Amazing to be here. First of all, before I get started, I just am remembering a year ago, I was sitting right there, wondering to myself, how in the world could I raise a fund? I'd done some syndications and really liked venture capital. And anyway, it's just amazing to see what an event like this can do for somebody, a nobody like me, to help me believe in myself and gave me permission to kind of go for it. And so just a big thank you to Fund Launch and the guys here. Give them a hand. So recently, yes, we partnered with Lincoln, and by the way, it's been a phenomenal journey with them, and they have helped us immensely. But yes, our fund is venture capital, and if you guys don't know this, in 2023, venture capital got decimated. And valuations were down about 60%, and so I thought to myself, there's no better opportunity, no better vintage year than 2024 to start a venture capital fund. And so that's what we did, is we went out and started raising money behind that just original thesis. We also thought that investing out of Utah was a phenomenal opportunity for us. It happens to be where I went to school. But just a couple things here. So if you guys don't know this, but of all the universities in the United States, BYU and Provo, Utah, has the fastest time from graduation to starting a unicorn or a private business that's valued over $1 billion. We have proprietary deal flow from there. My partner and business professor at BYU teaches 500 to 600 students a semester in entrepreneurship, and we get all of that deal flow. As well, the stats here, Utah on the bottom there, Utah would not be on the map at all 10 years ago when it comes to venture capital and unicorn businesses. And it's just been a ball of momentum. Entrepreneurs that have had exits pouring their time, their energy, their resources back into the state. If you guys saw just recently, this week, Ryan Smith brought a new NHL team to Utah. They bought the Utah Jazz, and it just seems like there's just tons of momentum behind it. We believe in the next 10 years, Utah will be past California per capita. Yeah, let's go, Utah. Now, the edge, Lincoln's talking about the edge. We have access to what is an accelerator called iHub, and iHub is a not-for-profit that provides 20,000 square feet of free office space to about 100 companies, and these companies have access to free legal and free accounting services and over 106 qualified mentors. And the stats show that a startup that has a qualified mentor, they have a 70% better chance of success. Now, there are all sorts of sources for deal flow for our fund, but this one we believe gives us an amazing edge. We've raised some great money. We've already made investments into 4 companies, and we're investing into 50 total companies, which is part of our strategy. When it comes to venture capital, people like to focus on their ability to have like the magic touch. Our approach is nobody has a magic touch, and we go back to the data, more of an index approach. So since 1983, if you put $100 into every pre-seed company, you would average a 22% return. Well, that's impossible to do in a fund. So the closest approximation of that is if you do 50 investments, it gets you about a 95% correlation to that index. So we're taking that approach as the base and then layering on top of that our expertise in investing in pre-seed and our proprietary deal flow to create alpha for our investors. Thanks, guys.
Phenomenal. Thank you, Tom. All right, isn't that cool? All right, give it another round of applause. A year ago, you know, he was thinking about starting a fund, and here he is today. Launched, they're up and running. Phenomenal. Look, your proprietary source of deal flow is everything, in my opinion. I think that's going to be, like, I cannot stress enough how much you guys should be focusing on that, of having incredible sources of deal flow. Especially as you start talking to bigger money, like that's what's really is going to move the needle for them. Because again, everyone looks the same. we looked at, we looked at 10, 50, probably 50 different venture funds. We really liked this one because of their proprietary source of deal flow. Another comment I just want to touch on about All In is their size. It's only a $20 million fund, which is actually really good for seed. As you look at the seed market, if they were raising more than $100 million, it's a lot harder to compound larger dollars. So as emerging fund managers, for all of you guys, like when you're raising a first-time fund, like a smaller fund, oftentimes it's going to be a lot easier to generate a return and compound interest there. All right, so we've talked about All In Ventures. We talked about their edge in starting a fund. So asset class, you got to sell them on the asset class. You got to sell them on your strategy. And then you also have to sell investors on your team. Really, your team, you're answering the question, who's doing the investing? So we talk about expert investor, capital raiser, and fund manager, right? Those are the three core roles. I want to go a little deeper and give you some insight here. So as you're putting your team together, it's important to just self-analyze yourself and ask yourself, what is brought to the table by each of the individuals on my team? There's four different things I think that are primarily brought to the table with different partners on your fund. Experience. You got to have experience on your team. You know, you can work 20 years in an industry and have phenomenal experience. You need to have expertise on your team. It's very different than experience, right? Maybe a professor at a university can be, incredible at data and just know their industry inside and out, but they actually don't have any experience. But you need both. I've also talked to operators who've done a lot of deals, but they don't know what the hell they're talking about half of the time. And so you need to have both expertise and experience. You also need to have a track record, right? Track record is different from experience, right? You can work in industry 20 years and have great experience, but a track record is deal history in your asset class that you're pursuing. If you're doing self-storage, I want to see that you've done, as I evaluate managers, I want to see that you've done deals in self-storage, right? And that you have actually extremely relevant experience. And again, somebody on your team needs to have that. And then you also need to have capacity, right? You need to be able to deploy those dollars that you raise. So when we talk about expert investor, fund manager, and capital raiser, those are typically going to be general partners of the firm, right? So there's a couple different types of positions. Your general partners are your go-to, right? Like they're the individuals that are running the shop. They're running the firm. They're making all the core decisions. Typically, majority equity holders in the business. But there's others that I don't think we talk about enough that I want to touch on. You also have advisors that you can bring in, right? Bringing on somebody that has expertise or somebody that has a track record in the industry, somebody that has experience on your advisory team. And they can be extremely active or they can be a lot more passive. There's also operating partners. We hardly ever talk about this enough. But there's an operating partner is maybe you're a venture fund and you're analyzing an industry that you're not an expert in. And so you bring on an operator, an operating partner to your team to help analyze this industry. Maybe you're in private equity and you need help on managing your portfolio companies. And maybe you have this incredible fractional consultant that is going to come in and help working with your portcos. Maybe you, in real estate, right? If you have a subcontractor that, it's like a proprietary subcontractor that you're using on all of your deals, right? They're kind of extensions of your team. Typically, they're going to be 1099 employees or 1099 or employees, and they might have a small piece of carry of the economics of the firm, but they're still an extension of your team, right? Like, a sophisticated investor wants to see that you have depth, all right? Additionally, you can bring an investment committee on, right? Multiple individuals with expertise to fill the gaps that you have. And then last, there's service providers are an extension of your team, right? And then obviously, employees. An important thing to note, another question over the past 2 days that I got a million times is, how long have you and your partners worked together? Have you and your partner done a deal together, right? That's an extremely important factor. So as you guys are building your teams, I mean, I just want you to start doing deals together as quickly as possible. I don't care if it's syndicated or if co-invest or if it's through the fund, but like at the end of the day, you just need momentum in your business. And that's what's, I mean, it's hard to stop a business that has momentum, right? It truly is. So you just got to get going. You just got to start doing, deals as quickly as possible. So for me, I mean, I'll just be transparent. You know, we recently just kicked off Fund Launch Partners. And as I was piecing this fund together, I'll talk to you about some of the gaps I felt I had and how we filled those gaps. For example, like one of the main reasons that emerging fund managers fail is due to operational inefficiencies. You guys may know how to invest, but you don't know how to run an investment management business. There's a lot of things from KYC to capital calls to investor reporting to running the infrastructure of the business that you guys need help on. And gosh, I haven't worked for 20 years in back office of funds. I just haven't. That's an area that I knew, you know, doing this GP Stakes fund, going out and partnering and investing with emerging fund managers, I'd need to have that gap filled. So guess what? I went and brought on Adam Campbell, who you heard from yesterday, as a general partner of the firm. This guy was the number 2 employee at Bridge Investment Group. He essentially was a key person in standing up their back office infrastructure, right? Then he went and ran the back office of a large family office. Like, I mean, he is critical in making this fund work. That was a gap I had, and we brought him on to as a general partner to fill that gap. Additionally, I'm investing across industries. We're industry agnostic in our GP Stakes fund, which is again tough. To be allocated to multiple industries. And so I said, look, we're investing across the landscape. Like, I need somebody that has decades of experience in asset allocation, right? That can help, you know, guide the portfolio allocations as we're developing based on, you know, current economies. So I went and brought on TJ Bond to our team. This guy is the former chief economist at Merrill Lynch. He is also the former chief economist and strategist at 2 major sovereign funds. He's allocated hundreds of billions of dollars into the alternative space, right? This guy knows asset allocation better than anyone out there. And so he fills that gap that I was insufficient in, right? Additionally, I've worked with funds for, you know, a number of years. I've consulted thousands of you, worked with thousands of you. But gosh, I actually haven't sat down and selected fund managers for 20 years. I just haven't done that, right? I need somebody on my team. I need somebody on my investment committee, in particularly, that's selected fund managers. So manager selection was an area that I felt weak in. So I need somebody on my team that has manager selection experience. So I went and brought on Trenton Smith. This guy, he stood up the alts portfolio at AAA and Dow. He's deployed about $4.5 billion into emerging fund managers, primarily on first and second time funds. This guy knows manager selection better than anyone else, right? And so I brought him on to fill that gap. Additionally, I've done funds before. I've consulted for interest in a number of funds. It's actually pretty comical. My former deals that I've done, the contracts were like 6 pages long. And I was like, gosh, if I'm gonna go acquire interest in these businesses, I need to have best in class service providers to make sure I'm doing it right and I'm doing it the way the industry does it. So we interviewed 20 different law firms, and we brought Jackson Walker on to do our service provider, do our investment agreements. Our contracts went from 6 pages to almost 100, right? Better protecting our investors and being better stewards of investor capital. So as you guys are building your funds, it's like, just be self-critical. Go ask people, right? Like, say, hey, where are my gaps, right? Where do you think I'm falling short? What type of person would make you feel more confident in allocating with this fund? Because your team is a core part of your edge, right? As you know, as you were thinking about asset allocation and when you had $100 million, that's an easy way to sort out, right? If they don't have proper credentials or people don't have experience, like that's a pretty easy way to say pass on those types of candidates. All right, so we've talked about your asset class. We've talked about your team, and we've talked about your strategy. The last core pillar of your offer and your edge is your structure. So me and Bridger have actually debated a lot on this. This is a core pillar for emerging managers specifically, all right? The reason being is your structure, oftentimes, it isn't gonna like make a deal a lot of the times, but it's certainly gonna kill it, all right? Like if you have poor structure and you haven't done things right, it's an easy way to just say, nope, pass, right? What I mean by structure, let me give you two examples. Let me give you two examples of poor structure. First, there was a firm that we were underwriting. Phenomenal experience, phenomenal team, phenomenal track record. Everything was great. And we started reading through their docs, because I know they're 100 pages long. I know you may think that investors don't read them, but they do, okay? So in your LPA and PPM we were reading, they were front-loading their fees. They basically, their management fee, the 2% annual management fee, they were gonna charge that up front the first 5 years. So basically 90% of the capital would just go into the fund, and then they were gonna take a 10% haircut day one. I said, absolutely not, right? Like what happens 4 years down the road when these asset needs managers and you have no income, you have no financial incentive to manage these assets? I think that's a really terrible way and a terrible alignment of interest. There's very poor structure, I'm out, right? Fortunately, they ended up changing it because they saw how much we balked at it. But again, structure can kill a deal for emerging fund managers. A second example, I was recently underwriting a hedge fund. They'd already had $20 million under management. They were doing great, great performance, great team. Like everything was phenomenal about this hedge fund. And I start looking at their P&L. Of their, returns and their financial reports, and it is a $20 million fund, and they had worked up to about $1 million a year in expenses, and I started looking at it, I was like, what is going on here? And they were like, oh, we're doing best in class. You know, they had like one of the big four firms, they had like a master feeder fund structure set up, didn't even have any international investors. They were like ready to be a billion-dollar firm, and I was like, that's great, that's phenomenal. But you're doing it at the wrong time, right? Like, if I'm an investor, those expenses are reimbursable to the fund, meaning that you have to generate a 5% return that year before your investors even start to make money, just to cover the load cost of this fund. Right? And I said, absolutely not, right? I'm starting 5% in the hole. Like, that's great that you have these things, but it's the wrong time. You only have $20 million under management. You have to be good stewards of investment capital. I honestly believe that there was very poor judgment and very poor business decisions. They're not thinking about their investor capital when they're making those decisions, right? I mean, who wants to start 5% negative each year? And, you know, for that reason, we passed. So again, your structure is—it's important. Like, sure, you can have special economics on your fund, right? You can put together really creative deals, and with a big anchor LP, you might have to. All we're looking for is industry standard or better, right? Like, you don't. Yeah, but it's an important part of it as you're bringing your product to market. So as we start to wrap up here, I want to. Quickly touch on this. So we've talked about the four pillars of a good offer, right? Depending on who you're talking to, you need to focus on different things. So if you're talking to an unsophisticated investor, or they're new to funds, or it's a unique asset class, like, they're not thinking, we went through that example, they're not thinking, which real estate fund should I invest in, or which hedge fund should I invest in? They're saying to themselves, man, should I invest in real estate? Is that a good idea, right? Or should I invest in private equity? Is that a good idea? Or should I invest in hedge funds? Is that a good idea? So when you're communicating your offering to unsophisticated investors, they're new to funds, or it's a unique strategy, like in your 20-minute pitch or in your 1-minute elevator pitch, like first of all, you need to know your investors, and you need to cater, you need to talk about your asset class probably a lot more than you think, right? You need to go, you need to explain it to a high schooler or an elementary kid, right? Like, that you've got to be able to communicate your asset class simply. On the other side of things, if you're talking to institutional grade capital, or you're talking to sophisticated investors for that matter, right? They already know their asset allocation. They know what sectors they like. They know what sectors they don't like. Sure, you can try and sell them on why they should have exposure to that asset class, but I mean, you're fighting an uphill battle. It's a lot. Look, it's important to note, like, sometimes you just got to accept. Like, I hate it when people get down and they're like, oh, I went and pitched like three different groups and they just said no. It's like half of the time it's just because they're not interested in that asset class. Like, why are you taking it so personally, right? Fundraising is it's a numbers game, right? And so when you're talking to these sophisticated LPs, you got to focus on your strategy, right? You got to focus on your team. You got to focus on that edge. What's your proprietary X? What makes you different, better, or special than the fund they just got pitched 20 minutes ago? Right? And so, and by focusing on your asset class, typically, unless it's a unique asset class, is oftentimes kind of a waste of time. So, in summary, there's a million things you can talk about when you're pitching your offer, when you're pitching your edge and your fund, your product that you're selling. There's four main things that you got to focus on when communicating your offer. Got to sell them on the asset class. Investors got to know what they're investing in. You got to sell them on your strategy. They got to know why you're different, better, or special than the next guy. Why you, right? Like, why you as the team? Why you as the sponsor? What makes you great? Are you qualified to manage this capital? And do you have the appropriate structure? Guys, I'm confident that if you follow these simple principles, these fundamentals, right, it's gonna increase your ability to raise more money and be a successful fund manager. Thank you so much for your time. Hope you enjoy the day. Thank you.
All information shared are solely the thoughts and opinions of the author or guests. Content is for educational purposes only. Do not take any information from the show as financial, investment, tax, or legal advice. Seek counsel from a licensed professional before taking action in any business pursuit. We're not selling or soliciting a security in any way, shape, or form. The host may maintain positions in securities discussed on this podcast. Guests on the show may be current or historical clients of Fund Launch Partners, or Black Card Capital Partners.